Dr. Grove asked me before dinner, why was it I thought Father Chris had to pray for me, you know, for my lecture, and now I know. Anyway, thank you, I think. There was some interest there that I was interested to find out I had. Okay. Last year, when Dr. Roberts and I first met with the senior class in a course we were co-teaching, Dr. Roberts asked what was on their minds, and one of them said that he had never understood why the students of Wyoming Catholic College have to memorize poems every semester in humanities. This response was a little disconcerting. At the time, Dr. Roberts and I were both new to the college, whereas this was the fourth year for these seniors. Neither of us had any winged words for an answer, as they say in Homer. So we did what teachers do in such circumstances. We nodded sagely. Yeah. In the year and a half since then, some of the reasons for this practice, distinctive to Wyoming Catholic College, have begun to unfold. At the banquet before graduation last year, some of you I know were there, the seniors got up and recited, or maybe it's better to say performed, a number of poems they especially loved. And almost every other student also knew these poems. It would be hard to find any other college, anywhere, I suspect, where so many students know so many poems by heart. But the question of why they memorize them keeps coming up. One of the bolder freshmen asked it last semester. Even members of the Humanities Committee ask it. Part of what I want to do tonight on this feast in honor of Our Lady, Seat of Wisdom, is to answer the question literally and then use it as a way of approaching what strikes me as the real question, which is the place of poetry in the larger sense, including the lyric poems we memorize in the liberal arts curriculum of a Catholic college like ours. Literally, or perhaps I should say historically, the practice of memorizing poetry derives from the earliest days of the college, when it was instituted by Dr. Robert Carlson, who thought that educated people should have poetry as part of who they are. The practice survives because the professors who taught students these poems have repeatedly found it a fruitful practice. On one level, it's like knowing prayers or hymns. It allows a community to speak with one voice, and in doing so, it helps shape what the community is. For example, I know that the freshmen, probably the whole college, will remember John Keats's On First Looking into Chapman's Homer. Is that true? Much have I traveled in the realms of gold in many goodly states. Okay, all right, good. And Gerard Manley Hopkins' God's Grandeur.
Will destroy the grandeur of God.
Okay, all right. Whole poems, right, are instantly present without recourse to a text. Did you want to do it, Dr. Kaczynski? Never mind. And reciting these poems has its own pleasures, as we all find. All that great language alive in this moment, you know, with the very air you breathe. And on another more personal level, these poems, once they're held for a time and revived in the memory, begin to reveal why memory is a spiritual resource rather than a kind of hard drive. When St. Augustine writes about memory and time, one of his major examples is a psalm he knows by heart. And by heart, with all the implications of really caring about something, is the way the English language teaches us to think about what we've memorized. To know something by heart means that you've taken it deeply into the center of who you are. When you know a poem by heart, you find that you can not only recite it, but also relive it and let it unfold in new ways, line by line, revealing new subtleties that you might have missed in the reading or the recitation. But the shaping force of a memorized poem has already laid its claim. Long before I ever make a technical point about, say, the turn between the octave and the sestet in a Petrarchan sonnet, or even fully discuss what a sonnet is. Those who know sonnets by heart have already felt their nature. For example, it's in the first eight lines of God's Grandeur. No, just kidding. Hopkins describes how a world originally charged with the grandeur of God has become inaccessible to modern man because generations, you can do it here, generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. So just when this plodding, repetition, and world weariness seems to take over, Hopkins turns the poem in the ninth line. And yet, for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down within. Or think about... there you go, right? Or think about Keats's great sonnet, written when he was just 21. Keats uses the first eight lines of the poem to describe the works of great literature, you recall, as the realms of gold, the goodly states and kingdoms of a known world. Let's call it the world of classical literature, or the literary canon, if you prefer. He's often heard of the wide expanse that deep-browed Homer holds as his domain. He's even read Homer in Alexander Pope's translation. But he has never really understood what people mean by praising Homer so highly until he reads George Chapman's Elizabethan version. If you haven't read any of Chapman's Homer, you should take a look at it. There's a passage that right when Odysseus crawls on shore after he leaves Calypso's island, that if you compare it to Pope, you really see where Keats got it. The way Chapman translates one line about how Odysseus felt his heart was soaked through, you know, something like that. There's a kind of vividness to it that gets sort of glossed over in the way that Pope translates it. So, till I heard Chapman speak out loud and bold. So, what's reading Chapman's Homer like? Keats tries to describe it with a bold turn in the ninth line. You remember it? Then felt I, like some watcher of the skies, when a new planet swims into his ken. Okay, this isn't the known classical world. What we're suddenly into is something new, something distinctly modern. A whole new planet swims into someone's ken. K-E-N, right? It's this wonderful word. It means it's hard to find a one-word synonym for ken. It's a whole range of vision, a range of knowledge that's caught up in that word. So this new planet swims into his ken. Now, who discovers new planets? Modern astronomers. In this case, probably William Herschel, whose telescope allowed him in 1781 to find Uranus, the first new planet since antiquity. Keats's point is that what Herschel must have felt in that moment was this essential wonder of it, an emotion analogous to his own. In his preface to Lyrical Ballads, which Keats had certainly read, Wordsworth describes poetry as the impassioned expression in the countenance of all science. And in that sense, Herschel's moment of discovery was already poetry. But then comes an even bolder comparison. Keats thinks of the explorer who first stood on a mountain peak in Panama and saw the Pacific Ocean, a whole ocean much vaster than the Atlantic, and one whose existence no European had even suspected. He imagines how the men looked at each other with a wild surmise. Historically, of course, we know, right? It was Balboa, wasn't Cortez. But this moment of wonder and sublimity, like the astronomers, breaks the known world, even more than the discovery of the Americas. It extends the boundaries of the imaginable. This is the moment that distinctively epitomizes the modern spirit. But Keats is not talking about science or exploration. He's talking about reading a 200-year-old translation of Homer. George Chapman gets Homer, who is suddenly no longer part of the guided tour of tamed and categorized literature represented by Alexander Pope's translation. Ironically, it takes a new planet or the Pacific Ocean to describe the astonishment of feeling the poetry of Homer for the first time. Homer, the very oldest poet of the classical tradition, who now feels radically remade, radically new. To know Homer this way throws open the gates of the wonder world at the very sources of the West. A third sonnet that our students memorize deals with very much the same thing, the idea that the economic promise of the modern world, with all its wealth and technological novelty, nevertheless lacks something that we find in the ancients. Wordsworth's most famous sonnet begins with a lament about the commercial and industrial preoccupations of the modern world have done to us. Ready? The world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. Time no longer has any leisure in it. No sense of holiday or Sunday rest. Something is always late, don't you find? Something always has to be done soon. Nothing any longer has the quality of a simple gift. Everything is a matter of getting things and spending money, except everything that is except what counts most, our hearts, which most connect us to the world. Not valuing the heart in terms of economic valuation, we've given the most important thing away for nothing, which makes the gift a sordid boon. You see Wordsworth's meaning there. It's like giving away our honor or our chastity. But so what? What difference does it make? What are we actually missing as a result of our heartlessness? For Wordsworth, the sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers, for this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. Technically, as we know from the other sonnets and from the long tradition of the Petrarchan form, the turn should come after the end of the eighth line. We are out of tune. But Wordsworth doggedly keeps going, continuing the thought, delaying the turn by four syllables. It moves us not. Four stern, hard-headed syllables that anticipate Thomas Gradgrind in Dickens' Hard Times with his emphasis on facts, nothing but facts. Why should we care how sonnets work or whether we're in tune? It moves us not. We aren't interested in all that poetic claptrap. But it is a sonnet. We do have an expectation of the turn, and because of the delay, these utilitarian words, it moves us not, burn like a fuse. And when the turn belatedly comes in the second half of the line, it explodes in exclamation and protest. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. The speaker of the poem had rather be a pagan than live as we do, getting and spending. Does he mean a pagan instead of a Christian? Does he blame Christianity for our worldliness and our estrangement from nature? Maybe in a sense I'll return to later, but mostly he criticizes a rote inertia of religious practice, what Newman will later call a civil religion, when our real treasure is in everything conventional and man-made, and money and work that never stops, not in the sacramental character of the natural world or the demands of the divine. Like Keats, he sees in the ancients the kind of imagination that fills us with wonder. Proteus, the old man of the sea, the shapeshifter of the Odyssey, makes the sea, at least in some imaginable sense, ours, as does Triton blowing his great conch shell with the howling of the winds. What Wordsworth emphasizes is the lost beauty and sublimity of our poetic engagement with the given world, and it comes here as a direct counter to the increasingly bureaucratized, alienated life of the factory and the office that we see throughout the rest of the 19th century in such works as Gogol's Overcoat, Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener, Dickens' Hard Times or Bleak House, Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Illich. Later in that century, Hopkins answers Wordsworth in God's Grandeur, which starts with the same two words, the world, but takes a different tack. Hopkins in his sestet does not turn to the ancients. After showing a world that wears man's smudge and shares man's smell, he gives us an image of apocalyptic promise. And yet for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with awe. That's ultimately Dr. Baxter's fault. The dearest freshness, deep down things, comes with morning. I'm reminded of another poem by Wordsworth, this one about London, which is usually noisy and filthy. And he sees it early in the morning as he crosses Westminster Bridge. The city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning, silent, bare, ships, towers, domes, theaters, and temples lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smoke and fire. But Hopkins adds to this morning renewal the metaphor of the brooding bird, drawing on the image of the Holy Spirit descending as a dove. The Holy Ghost over the bent world broods. And notice that violent emphasis on the word bent. Violent because the adjective modifying world receives the whole stress of the rhyme. Spent, went, bent. But unlike those earlier words, which end a clause and have a kind of finality, bent does not. In itself, over the bent means nothing and concludes nothing, since it needs the word world in its verb at the start of the next line. So it's a violent enjambment, like crush earlier in the poem, like the ooze of oil, crushed, right? But here, the strain on the word bent bends the feel of the poem. The next line starts off balance with a heavy spondee, world broods. The bent world. We do not so much picture as feel the heavy off-kilter world on its axis. The enlivening presence of the Holy Ghost makes this bent world stir from within. And we know it because a poetic pleasure stirs within us. It promises to bring forth the freshness deep down things. But more than that, an apocalyptic newness. Hopkins' poem is not only about the renewal of morning, in other words, but the promise that in time the world itself will break open with God's grandeur. In short, the turn in each of these sonnets we've taken to heart is about a poetic renewal of the world. In each case, it's a claim about poetry, the necessity of poetic imagination for fullness of life. In each case, it's about what I'm calling the witness of poetry to the inner richness of the world. At the beginning of his book, Creative Intuition in Art and Poetry, Jacques Maritain explains what he means by his title. By art, I mean the creative or producing, work-making activity of the human mind. By poetry, I mean not the particular art which consists in writing verses, but a process both more general and more primary, that inner communication between the inner being of things and the inner being of the human self, which is a kind of divination. Poetry, in this sense, is the secret life of each and all the arts, another name for what Plato called musike. Now, just to take up Maritain's distinction for a moment, we think about the art of Keats or Hopkins or Wordsworth as the work-making activity of writing a 14-line Petrarchan sonnet, learning to employ the 10-syllable iambic pentameter line, for example, and answering the particular demands of a rhyme scheme, following the logical structure of the two quatrains of the octave, the eight-line exposition of a problem or situation, then fitting the answer to the problem in the six lines of the sestet. Meeting the requirements of this conscious art requires a great deal of thought and attention, especially at first. I imagine it's like learning to ski, as some of you, I think, did over the break. Or ride a horse, or I have to add, breakdance like a philosopher. Or perhaps that was poetry last night rather than art. Poetry, in Maritain's extended sense, is something deeper than art per se. It's precisely the kind of divination that both Hopkins and Wordsworth call for, that inner communication between things and us. At first, we might wonder what Maritain can mean by the inner being of things. The innerness raises the question. If he had said the being of things and the being and the inner being of the human self, we would have had less of a question. But as an example of what he might mean, let me use two examples from Homer. The first comes in Book 4 of the Iliad, when the Greeks and the Trojans have just declared a truce with the potential to end the war and spare many lives. Menelaus and Paris, remember this duel, are fighting to see who gets Helen, which will settle the central issue of the war, and Menelaus is clearly winning. He's dragging Paris by the helmet, and it's the chin strap, right, that's holding him. But instead of letting the duel take its course, Aphrodite intervenes, breaks the chin strap, spirits Paris out of the battle, and puts him where? In the confusion that follows, Zeus prods Hera and Athena into having the Trojans break the truce and rekindle the war. Athena takes the form of a Trojan warrior, approaches a man named Pandarus, and convinces him to use his famous skill as an archer to shoot Menelaus. Homer gives six lines to the description of the bow and how it was made from the horns of a great goat before turning to the shot itself. Pandarus stripped away the lid of the quiver and took out an arrow feathered and never shot before, transmitter of dark pain. Swiftly he arranged the bitter arrow along the bowstring, and made his prayer to Apollo, the light-born, the glorious archer. He drew, holding at once the grooves and the ox-hide bowstring, and brought the string against his nipple, iron to the bowstave. But when he had pulled the great weapon until it made a circle, the bow groaned, and the string sang high, and the arrow, sharp-pointed, leapt away, furious to fly through the throng before it. The American poet and critic John Crow Ransom borrows a term from the German Dinglichkeit, the materiality or thingliness of something, to describe the vividness of a poetic evocation. On the level of art, Homer uses the figure of personification. The bow groans, the string sings, the arrow leaps and flies with fury. But on the level of poetry, he divines the inner being of these things by finding in them a communication with our inner being through the imagination. In distinguishing between fancy and imagination, Samuel Taylor Coleridge writes that objects as objects are merely fixed and dead. But this bow and this arrow, these things, are by no means dead. They gather us into the very act of being what they are in the moment of their fulfilled purpose. This is what a bow and arrow are for. This is what they do. And here they reveal their inner being to the imagination. After almost 3,000 years, there's a distinct now in what we're seeing as that arrow flies furiously through the throng before it toward Menelaus. It comes to us live. The other Homeric example is from Book 5 of the Odyssey, when the god Poseidon sees Odysseus on his way home after escaping from Calypso's island and goes after him. I have to say that some of the freshman men last semester were not altogether sure why Odysseus wanted to escape from Calypso's island. Took some convincing, right? In any case, Poseidon hates Odysseus for blinding his son, the Cyclops Polyphemus, and he rouses a great storm, stirring up the waves and the winds to smash Odysseus' raft into splinters. In a recent book on Homer, Adam Nicholson, who's a lifelong sailor, quotes the passages about the storm and then draws upon his own experience at sea. "If there is one fact that a storm seems to impose," he writes, "it is the sea's mysterious dominance from below. A storm-driven sea appears to acquire a vitality and viciousness, a desire to do damage, which has nothing to do with the wind, but comes from inside its own enraged, destroying body. If you ever have that sensation, it is when you are meeting Poseidon." For Nicholson, Homer's poetry is not a matter of mere personification, but a compelling description of this real encounter with another will, another body, with its inner vitality and viciousness, its desire to do damage. In other words, Homer divines the inner being of the sea more profoundly than any account of cross currents and wind could do. What does it mean to have lost this experience of the sea? That seems to me exactly what Wordsworth asks as well. The poetry lies in this apprehension of what the thing is for us, with respect to us, not in terms of its utility, but in a way that ennobles us imaginatively. Take Wordsworth's line in the second quatrain of the sonnet as an example. "The sea that bears her bosom to the moon." As a rhetorical figure, it's a personification of the sea as a woman. Behind it might be a recollection of Hecuba on the walls of Troy, desperately baring her breast to her son Hector to remind him of his former helplessness and the helplessness Troy will feel if he dies at the hands of Achilles. In other words, this gesture of the sea in that case would have something pleading in it, a last hope for rescue. But perhaps we don't need to go that far. As an image, it's about her gesture, which can be read as less desperate than bold, passionate, erotic. As an idea, it's surely about the waters of the earth responding to the gravitation of the moon. If we take the idea as the point, we disenchant the image. But if we discount the idea entirely, we fail to see the whole import of this personification, this answering of the sea to the moon, this appeal. As poetry, it's a way of making the sea ours, not as possession, but as a means of human, not as a means of human commerce, but as alive and knowable through ourselves and our own emotions. Of course, we can no longer unself-consciously personify the world as the ancients did. For us, a forest is more likely to be what Martin Heidegger calls standing reserve, either for the timber industry or for tourism, than to be full of dryads or sacred groves. For us, rivers may be beautiful, clear, good for trout fishing. But the Poposia or the Wind River will never be, for most of us, a person, a god, as it would be in Homer. When Odysseus swims for land after Poseidon's devastating storm, he sees a river and prays to it to smooth his way out of the surface, and the river accommodates him. In the Iliad, the river Scamandros gets furious with Achilles for cramming his watercourses with the dead bodies of Trojans, and he comes out of his banks and chases Achilles across the plain, one of the more difficult passages to imagine, until Hephaestus intervenes. Later, Achilles apologizes to a river back in his homeland, Spercheios, for cutting the lock of hair he had been growing for him. Apparently a common practice for ancient Greeks. You'd grow a lock of hair in dedication to a particular god or whatever. Since Achilles now knows that he will die in Troy, he puts the lock instead on the pyre of Patroclus. And in doing so, he brings a whole river of grief to bear on the gesture. No wonder the pyre will not light at first. Everywhere in Homer, the things and forces of the world are animated with intelligences that have to be acknowledged and placated. It's never simply man as the only thinking subject versus the rest of the world as unthinking object, but man in a world of presences that know him and most often exceed him. In an excellent recent article in the New Atlantis, called Fantasy and the Buffered Self, Alan Jacobs, who's a professor at Baylor, quotes a passage from the philosopher Charles Taylor that speaks directly to this point. As Taylor writes, we live in a much less enchanted world. We might think of this as having lost a number of beliefs and the practices which they made possible. But more, the enchanted world was one in which these forces could cross a porous boundary and shape our lives, psychic and physical. One of the big differences between us and them is that we live with a much firmer sense of the boundary between self and other. We are buffered selves. Now, Taylor's surely right. Already by the time of Shakespeare, the porous self feels like something remembered rather than experienced. For example, in A Midsummer Night's Dream, remember Puck and Titania and Oberon and all the fairies. It seems like a remembered world, not one that anybody any longer inhabits. Perhaps The Tempest, one of his last plays, is both homage and farewell to that kind of world. Elsewhere, Iago seems to voice the spirit of the age. 'Tis in ourselves that we are thus or thus. By contrast, as Jacobs comments, to a pre-modern person, in Taylor's account, to be a pre-modern person is to be constantly in danger of being invaded or overcome by demons or fairies or nameless terrors of the dark. Or though he's speaking more of the Middle Ages than he is of the ancients, but you could say the same thing about possession by Aphrodite or by a deluding Athena. Forces are out there which can affect you and change what you are. It is easy then, says Jacobs, to imagine why a person or a whole culture might, if it could, exchange this model of a self, this porous self, with highly permeable boundaries for one in which the self feels better protected, defended, impermeable, or nearly so. The problem with this apparently straightforward transaction is that the porous self is open to the divine as well as to the demonic, while the buffered self is closed to both alike. So there's the problem of the modern buffered self, is that it's in being protected from all those forces that would formally impinge on it, it's also protected from ones that come from above. Taylor and Jacobs argue that this enchantment took on greater force with the Reformation, which reinforced the biblical injunctions against divinizing the forces of nature, and combined with modern science to disenchant our understanding of phenomena. When Wordsworth says more than 200 years ago, little we see in nature that is ours, he already sees this problem. We are so buffered that nothing moves us. The answer he proposes is not a return to animism, but again, a recourse to the witness of poetry. Maritain's definition helps us understand what the word ours might mean in Wordsworth's line. Ours through a kind of divination, an inner communication between the inner being of things and the inner being of the human self. An intercommunication means that we do not simply impose human characteristics on things. Rather, they communicate to us what they are as we communicate ourselves to their inner being. The point is precisely that the world outside us is not alien. Maritain calls this kind of communication knowledge through connaturality. In this kind of knowing, as he puts it, the intellect is at play not alone, but together with affective inclinations and the dispositions of the will, and is guided and directed by them. In other words, an emotion such as love or pity or awe might guide us to what we know. You have to, in connatural knowledge, there's, you know, you have to be moved by some kind of emotional openness to what it is that you're seeing. It's not rational knowledge, says Maritain, but it's genuinely knowledge, though obscure and perhaps incapable of giving account of itself or of being translated into words. For example, we might know what courage is in someone when we see it without being able to satisfy Socrates with an adequate definition, right? Now, the other day, my wife and I came around the bend from Baldwin Creek to Squaw Creek Road, and we started east, and we saw this whole herd of horses galloping at full speed out on the meadows between the road and the mountains. The very look and manner of them made us feel like they did, unlikely as that might sound for the oldest members of the WCC family. They communicated the exhilaration of what they were to us. Now, how do you begin to say what that knowledge is, except that we share something of the same nature, at least by analogy? When connatural knowledge is translated into words, it's poetic language. Homer compares both Paris and Hector to some stalled horse who has been corn-fed at the manger, who, breaking free of his rope, gallops over the plain in thunder to his accustomed bathing place in a sweet-running river. And then the pride of his strength holds high his head, and the mane floats over his shoulders. Sure of his glorious strength, the quick knees carry him to the loved places and the pasture of horses. It's almost like students getting out of class. Now, Maritain bravely tries to explain where poetry like this comes from. Okay, bear with me a minute. He writes that connatural poetic knowledge comes about through the instrumentality of emotion, which, received in the preconscious life of the intellect, becomes intentional and intuitive, and causes the intellect obscurely to grasp some existential reality as one with the self it has moved. And by the same stroke, all that which this reality emotionally grasped calls forth as sign. Got that? If this sentence isn't immediately comprehensible, you might sympathize with what Byron quips about Coleridge, who had begun explaining metaphysics to the nation. I wish he would explain his explanation, Byron says. But let me explore Maritain's insight a little bit by thinking about Keats's great Ode to a Nightingale. In May of 1819, Keats was 23 years old. He had lost his beloved brother Tom at 19 to tuberculosis the previous December. And it may be that Keats already noticed some of the early symptoms of the same disease in himself. He would die of it less than 2 years later. On this May night, with the sorrow of early death very much on his mind, Keats hears this nightingale singing somewhere out there in the darkness. In Maritain's terms, the instrumentality of emotion becomes intentional and intuitive. In other words, Keats's imagination fixes enraptured on this bird singing in the dark, so much so that his own body sinks into oblivion. "As though of hemlock I had drunk," he says, "or emptied some dull opiate to the drains 1 minute past, and Lethewards had sunk." He imagines this light-winged dryad of the trees out in some melodious plot of beechen green and shadows numberless, where the bird is singing of summer in full-throated ease. Impelled by his underlying sorrow, the speaker obscurely grasped the existential reality of the nightingale. It seems strange to put it this way, but it's the real bird he hears as one with the self is moved, that is, one with himself. Bird and poet become one. The bird pouring forth his soul abroad is the poet grasping the very being of the nightingale emotionally and revealing this reality through stanza after stanza as the way of disclosing his own inner self. The poem moves us through the oneness Keats feels with the nightingale in embalmed darkness, this passionate lyric escape, and in the end, return to the soul self with which he began, as did we. What makes Maritain's understanding of poetry compelling is that it puts the emphasis on a kind of wedding between the deepest preconscious life of the intellect, that darkness out of which thought emerges, and the existential reality of things, their actuality, their limitation to what they are. He writes that it is essentially an obscure revelation both of the subjectivity of the poet and of some flash of reality coming together out of sleep in one single awakening. The limited particular keeps yielding more insight than one might imagine it could possibly contain. As we discovered in trivium class the other day, in thinking about Richard Wilbur's Two Voices in a Meadow, which is a poem personifying a milkweed and a stone, which you wouldn't think would be that promising. But the more you think into them, the more you see, you know, what Wilbur's doing with them. We were ending up talking about the active and contemplative life, you know, and so on. I mean, anyway, the mode of poetry is through what Father William Lynch calls the generative finite in Christ and Apollo, a book that Flannery O'Connor loved almost as much as Maritain's Art and Scholasticism. Stressing the universal limitation or particularity of the real world we inhabit and the real people we meet, he writes that the heart, substance, and center of the human imagination, as of human life, must lie in the particular and limited image or thing. This limitation is the real source of the power of poetry. As Lynch puts it, every plunge through or down into the real contours of being, the imagination also shoots up into insight. In other words, I mean, he gives a kind of diagram where you go down into the image, and having done so, you get much higher up than you would have had you not done this. In other words, poetry engenders insight by concentrating its focus not on clear concepts, which it then illustrates, but on the particularities of image or character or action. Not on grief, but on a particular nightingale. Not on ambition, but on Macbeth. Not on war per se, but on the trajectory of Achilles' wrath. As Maritain puts it in Art and Scholasticism, the artist achieves radiance of form, an ontological splendor, which is in one way or another revealed to our mind, not a conceptual clarity. In an essay on Dante, shortly after his conversion to Catholicism, Alan Tate calls this mode the poetic way. He writes that despite the timeless orders of both rational discourse and intuitive contemplation, it is the business of the symbolic poet to return to the order of temporal sequence, to action. In other words, the real task of the poet is never to go simply to the idea, but to go through the real world, through the action of characters, to find the real meaning of what he's writing. He says, if the poet is able to find in the things of the actual world we're looking at a coherent chain of analogies, he will inform an intuitive act with symbolism. His will be, in one degree or another, the symbolic imagination. And may I say, in honor of the occasion, that the very mode of revelation in our tradition corresponds to the way of the poet. That is, the entrance into the body of this world in a particular time and place. Near the beginning of his book, Father Lynch writes that he will be stressing the great fact of Christology, that Christ moved down into all the realities of man to get to his Father. Movement down through the particular might even be a kind of martyrdom for the poet, who might prefer to circumvent particularity and fly directly to essences. In other words, poetry might be a witness in another sense as well. Now let me close by turning to a poem by the poet Richard Wilbur and musing briefly on it. It's a poem called Love Calls Us to the Things of This World, whose very title seems to make the point of Father Lynch and Alan Tate. I always imagine the scene of this poem as a second-story room in one of those narrow Roman streets in the Trastevere, or maybe somewhere near the Campo di Fiore, maybe a little street called Via Poetica, on a morning when the Roman housewife has hung her laundry on a line from her window to an opposite one across the way, cranking it out item by item by pulling the rope for its pulleys. The speaker wakes up, or almost wakes up, and her laundry is his first vision of the morning. All right. Love calls us to the things of this world. The eyes open to a cry of pulleys. And spirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment, bodiless and simple as false dawn. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Some are in bed sheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly, there they are. And now they are rising together in calm swells of halcyon feeling, filling whatever they wear with the deep joy of their impersonal breathing. Now they are flying in place, conveying the terrible speed of their omnipresence, moving and staying like white water. And now, of a sudden, they swoon down into so rapt a quiet that nobody seems to be there. The soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember, from the punctual rape of every blessed day, and cries, "Oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands and the rising steam and clear dances done in the sight of heaven." Yet as the sun acknowledges with a warm look the world's hunks and colors, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice as the man yawns and rises, "Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone, and the heaviest nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance." Just a few last comments. It's a poem about laundry. But But it's also a poem about an almost Dantean experience of the ascent of the soul into the angelic orders. The laundry remains laundry, but for the moment of the soul's ecstasy, as it hangs, bodiless and simple, the angels fill the clothes on the line with the deep joy of their impersonal breathing. The wind whipping through the clothes becomes for an instant the terrible speed of their omnipresence. When they fall still, the soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember. The soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body. Why bitter love? Because it has experienced a moment of heaven, and it longs for nothing but that purity and holiness. But the way of the poet is not like that. On the via poetica, love calls us to the things of this world. What the poet can do is give this dirty and sinful place a reminder of the dearest freshness deep down things. Where will those garments worn by the angels go now? Onto the backs of thieves and lovers and nuns. Wilbur's last image of nuns is comic. Not just nuns, but the heaviest nuns. Somehow this also brings it wrong back to mind. The heaviest nuns who walk in a pure floating of dark habits, with that wonderful play on the word habits. The difficult balance is the thing between metaphor and existential reality, between animism and incarnation, between image and idea, between heaven and lander. May we have the grace to keep that balance. Thank you. About a few minutes for questions, and then we'll break up. Anybody? Yes.
Do you think we have to go through the buffered self stage to return, to get back to a higher level of participation? Even better than the ancients.
Yeah, I don't know.
Distinguished to unite, kind of thing.
Maybe so. I don't think there was. Let me put it this way. I think the ancients also had something like the buffered self. I think by the time you get to the late 4th century, 5th century BC, just before the death of Socrates, already in Athens, you're getting a sense that the old ways of things were going away. Maybe it's necessary. I think we have to say, sure, it's necessary, right, to get rid of that sense of being sort of at the mercy of the world. But then what does poetry become after that? It has to become something more conscious of what it is and what it can do. Alan Jacobs suggests that one of the ways that we have gotten back the poorer self is through fantasy literature, that when people enter into that, it's a way of recovering some feeling for that world. I think you get it when you read Homer. But, the question is how you do it in the actual world that we inhabit. And I think that's where a kind of poetic disposition comes into play. A willingness for metaphors to become, felt things and be taken seriously. But not too seriously. Not so much that you give way to fantasies that would quickly get you locked up for being schizophrenic. Doctor.
How do you become a really good reader of poetry?
Well, what does that mean? I think you. I'm tempted to say something about age here, but no. I think reading poetry well is simply a matter of kind of Well, it's like asking, how do you learn to play tennis well? Or how do you learn to, I keep using the tennis metaphor. I apologize to those of you in my classes. But think about any game that you know, like baseball or tennis. How do you learn to be a skillful observer, you know, of a game like that? How do you know what's a good play and what's not? It might help to do it yourself. It certainly helps to see a lot, right? To know what the rules are helps a lot. So that if you have a sense of the parameters and what's possible within those, then you get an expertise in judgment. And then I think seeing what's truly excellent and being able to tell it from what's not. I mean, if those of you watched the Super Bowl the other day, right? I mean, you come to that game, if you're like me, having seen a lot of football games, right? So that what happens in the last minute of the game has this particular, you know, amazing potency because of the outrageousness of these situations that here, I'm getting off onto the Super Bowl. But
that's a lot better than tennis. Keep going.
That catch, you know, and then, you know, okay, the whole thing. Brady can't take a knee. Why is that? Because if he takes a knee, it's going to be a safety. And you know the rules of the game, right? You know that if he takes a safety, that's 2 points for the other team, and the Patriots have to kick to Seattle, right? So that would mean Seattle gets the ball, and they still have time to score. So you know, all these subtleties go into how you understand, you know, the extraordinariness of a game like that. I think if you think of poetry in something of the same way, you see, you know, you know what an iambic pentameter line is, what blank verse is, what the usual ways of handling it are. And then you see Christopher Marlowe do something with it that just changes the whole way that the English language works. And then Shakespeare picks up what Marlowe does, and, you know, you've got something going on there that's pretty extraordinary. You learn what you can do in a poetic line, what a stanza is, right? What the kind of logic of a stanza is, and whether you can, whether the poet is using it in some thoughtful way that has a poetic sense to it or not. I mean, there are just a lot of things, but you know, the main one is, you know, is lots of practice, lots of reading, and thoughtful reading when you're doing it. Does that help? Okay. Annalise.
Dr. Roberts keeps telling us that we need to be the fire in the world to set the world. Are you with all? How would we bring this gift that we have been given of education and poetry and set others on a similar fire with this beauty?
Yeah, I think the idea of setting somebody on fire is, you know, it's going to require. You're not serious about that. No. I think if you have a sense of the poetic, then you avoid saying things in the way they've always been said, right? You avoid any way of letting somebody say, well, that's a cliche. I've heard that before. If you can say something in a new way that cracks it open, Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet, says that great poetry catches the heart off guard and breaks it open. You know, if you can do that with your language when you're talking to somebody, then I think that's one way, right? And I think poetry is a kind of, it's a steady training in that. That's what it really is. That's what it's about, is that capacity to kind of reopen the world. And surely that's what Hopkins is getting at in God's Grandeur. That's what the Holy Spirit does, right, is break open the world. It's a real bond, obviously, between what poetry is and the action of the Holy Spirit. Anybody else? Andy. You mean you were thinking about something else while I was talking?
A lot of people, or at least I think sometimes I hear struggling to find something new in the world, because that one piece that things can discover.
Yeah.
And do you think this poetry that we're studying here opens up, like, say, the grand canyon, in countless times in a new way that they've never seen before?
I think that's at least what it's urging upon us. Those three poems I sort of went through are all poems you do in the freshman year, and I think they're sort of telling you that's what you're after. You're looking for that experience where you can see something that's old, that's gotten old, right? It's worn out. There's nothing new about it. Generations have tried, right? Repetition, everything that might have sprung up seems like it's been beaten under. If you are having your expectation even, right, this possibility of the kind of newness that poetry seems to be about, I think that's what you want. And that may be a real discipline, you know, to maintain that kind of expectation. An openness to the world and to your response to it that, you know, makes that kind of newness possible. Anybody else? Is everybody thinking what they have to do for tomorrow? You've got so many things that are late. They're due so soon. Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate you.